Six music.
BBC Radio, six music documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to the first in a new season of The First Time here on Six Music. As always, this is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians in the world and take a look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. And we start this series with a man whose iconic guitar playing, songwriting skills, and distinctive vocals shaped some of the biggest-selling albums in the history of the world. He found acclaim as a member of Pink Floyd, but his solo career continues apace with the release of his new album, Rattle That Lock. My guest on The First Time this week is David Gilmour.
You say the hill's too steep to climb.
David's never really sought the spotlight, content as he is to play music rather than talk about it, but here we sit down and discuss his life and his influences, his love of the 60s folk scene, his experiences in 1967 meeting the Floyd and their mercurial frontman Syd Barrett, and how he coped with the huge fame that followed the release of the band's legendary 1973 album, The Dark Side of the Moon. He also talks about helping discover Kate Bush, his collaborations with author and writer Polly Sampson, and how the death of his friend and Floyd keyboardist Richard Wright has had an impact on his new material. We also track down David's first ever recordings by his band Joker's Wild, a 1965 disc that was never released commercially and is so rare we've had to find a copy at the British Library's National Sound Archive. But I start, as I do with all my guests, by asking David when he was first aware of music.
When I was a young child, I suppose, the radio was incredibly varied and we were exposed to all sorts of music on what was, the light programme. in those days. And my parents, who spent some time in America, had quite a collection of strange old 78s of blues records. So I was immersed, actually. My parents weren't in music, but they were very musical. So we lived in a household with a lot of it going on all around us.
What was your relationship like with that music? Was it something that you found yourself drawn to?
Yes, I loved it. All these old songs like Lazy Bones and stuff on old 78 records.
Lazy Bones, sleeping in the sun. How you expect to get your day's work done? You'll never get your day's work done. Sleeping in the noonday sun. Lazy Bones, sleeping in the shade. How you.
And life gets tedious, don't it? Do you know that one? Fantastic old song. Which were sort of, American sort of old 78s of a sort of blues, but sort of hillbilly music as well a little bit.
The sun comes up and the sun goes down. The hands on the clock keep going around. I just get up and it's time to lay down. Life gets tedious, don't it? My shoe's untied, but I don't care. I ain't figuring on going nowhere. I'd have to wash and comb my hair. That's just wasted effort. Water in the well getting lower and lower. Can't take a bath for 6 months more. But I've heard it said, and it's true, I'm sure, that too much bathing will weaken it.
But the first record I bought, and that really sort of turned me around a bit, was Rock Around the Clock.
Yeah.
By Bill Haley.
You're like,
when I was 10.
10 years old? Because, I mean, the idea of that is, the context was, there wasn't anything to kind of, there was no reference point for that music when it came out.
That, to me, is the, you know, everyone, I guess, has slightly different memories or different things that have sparked them off. But that was the first moment where I thought, this is something new and exciting and original. It was superseded within not very long by Heartbreak Hotel, Elvis Presley, which was a step up again. But that first moment with Rock Around the Clock was just, it's very hard to describe how sort of new and revolutionary that sounded to me at the time.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hot. We'll have some fun.
When did you first pick up a guitar? And what was that guitar like, and was it awful?
The very first time I picked up a guitar, I think, was when my next-door neighbour, Bill, was given one by his parents, and he had no interest in it whatsoever.
So it wasn't even yours?
It wasn't even mine, but I played it at his house, and then I think I asked if I could borrow it, and then I think I forgot to give it back.
Who are you emulating? Whose style were you trying to copy at that time?
It's so broad, it's so varied, you know, from folk music, from Pete Seeger was, you know, I had a Pete Seeger guitar tutor record when I was about 13 or something like that, which is an album with, you know, the first track was the six notes of the six strings of a guitar played to tune to, because he thought, you know, you needed to get your guitar in tune.
Well, if you want to play a guitar, let's take the first step, and that is get it in tune. Do you have a pitch pipe? The lowest string should be a bass E. And the next string to it is called the fifth string, should be an A.
That's lovely, I love that.
And that was fantastic. And then a chord of D, which he then taught you a song, which you just strummed one chord and could do a song, and instantly you could accompany yourself. It was great.
What's the Pete Seeger track we should play at this juncture?
I can't remember what the song was that's on it, but it's a Pete Seeger guitar tutor record that had a proper LP in those days, 12-inch, and it had a big book inside it which showed you all the chord shapes. And
fantastic.
That is where I learned guitar.
You know, you can sing a lot of songs with just this one chord. I gave my love a cherry that has no stone. I gave my love a chicken that has no bone. I told my love a story that has no end. And I gave my love a baby that's no crying.
What about your first live music experience?
It was probably one of those pop package tours in Cambridge when I was a kid, where all sorts of people, the Shadows and Gene Pitney and the Everly Brothers. I mean, the people who wandered through every town in those days is like a who's who of rock and roll. You'd be staggered these days.
Each doing about 15 minutes, and that
yeah.
was it.
Yeah.
Can you remember who you saw? Yeah, because you've talked about the Shadows. You've talked about Hank Marvin being someone that you looked up to quite a lot.
But Hank was one of the big influences. It's like playing a tune, you know, playing a melody. And I'm, by nature, I'm a melodic sort of person. So it's great to be able to combine that sort of thought of melody in music with a more bluesy approach and try and make something that falls somewhere in between all those things.
What was your first band like? Everyone's first band normally has a terrible name, and normally most of the gigs take place in like a living room somewhere.
I think the first band I actually properly joined was called The Newcomers.
Appropriate name.
And we were rubbish. We were dreadful.
Yeah. What did
I
you
wasn't
do?
The singer, I was just the guitar player.
What cover versions did you do rubbish versions of?
Do you know, I really can't remember. I can't remember what we did. It's a long, long time ago. Then I formed a band with some other guys, which we called Jokers of Arden. That was more ambitious. Did lots of Beach Boys songs. We were into big harmony stuff, Four Seasons, and all sorts of R&B records, you know, of the time, and the Beatles, everything. Covers of absolutely everything that was fun.
And apparently, like, one of the rarest, most collectible bits of vinyl, there was like sort of eight copies of something that you pressed up, isn't there? I was reading about this.
Yeah, we recorded five tracks. We went up in the van from Cambridge to London, went to the studio Regent Sound in Denmark Street, and recorded five tracks, and put two on a double-sided single and put five on a single-sided album. We printed 50 of each and sold them to our local fans back in Cambridge. I still have the master tape, though.
Really? Was David Gilmour's first ever recording by his band Jokers Wild from 1966. They recorded an EP of cover versions, and you heard a medley of that, which included Why Do Fools Fall in Love, Walk Like a Man, Don't Ask Me What I Say, Big Girls Don't Cry, and Beautiful Delilah. Only 50 copies of that were ever pressed, and it's now an incredibly rare record. So rare, in fact, we couldn't find a copy, so we had to enlist the help of the British Library Sound Archive to get that recording, complete with a crackle as the needle was put on the record.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Bob Dylan, your first experience with Bob Dylan, because that's obviously someone who's had an impact on you. Didn't your dad send you a record from the States, is that right?
My mum and dad were living in the States in 1960-61, and for my 16th birthday, they sent me two or three albums. One was Bob Dylan's first album in March 62. That was, I think, that's before it came out even in England.
Wow.
I also had the complete Newport Folk Festival 1959, and a guy called Eric Darling, who had Walk Right In. Do you remember that song, Walk Right In?
The
rooftop singers, they were
right.
Walk right in, set right down, Daddy, let your mind roll on. Walk right in, set right down, Daddy, let your mind roll on.
Everybody, what did you find appealing about the kind of folk scene? Because the music coming out of Greenwich Village is a very different world, too.
Yeah. I was like a sponge, I think. I mean, I didn't specialise in one form or the other. I just loved all different types of music for, yeah, everything. The blues, you know, Eric Clapton when he started, you know, was a big influence. Hank, as I said, and folk music. It all has, I suppose you say, combined in my subconscious to help create what I've tried to do ever since.
Can you remember the first rehearsal with Pink Floyd, the first time?
I can't remember the very first one, but I can remember one of the very first ones, which was in a school in North London, and we were all together, and it was with Sid as well, and he got us trying to learn a new song called Have You Got It Yet? And this is kind of legendary, and we played along with it and played this song for hours, it felt like, and every time he played it differently. So we never did get it yet, because every time we joined in, he was doing it slightly differently, and it was some elaborate, strange joke that he was playing on us, which I can remember that day clearly.
Thank you.
right from the start, did it feel like there was something special happening when you individuals played? That alchemical thing when certain people play together. Mm. Some of it's familiarity.
I couldn't really say that about my early moments with Pink Floyd. I thought that I could make them better, and I was trying to understand what they were trying to get at, which I didn't completely get right at the beginning, and it took me some time to get really into the flow of what they were attempting. Well, I my background was mostly covers of pop songs, you know, and I was moving into uncharted territory, moving into this sort of psychedelic thing, which I did like. But it took a while to find my feet and to know what to do.
'73, so Dark Side comes out. This is kind of your first experience with big mainstream success, the kind of success that there isn't really a map for.
Mm.
Did you enjoy it? Did you deal with it well, do you think?
It seems like a long time. It's a lifetime in pop music, you know, but I joined in January '68, and that was over 5 years later. And for those 5 years, we had been building up our stockpile of records, if you like, and all our music, and our audiences were growing and growing. We had, before Dark Side of the Moon, done shows at big places like the Hollywood Bowl, stuff like that. So it was a very gradual trajectory, and I'm very pleased, very glad that it took a long time of very gradual movement towards success. I think that it helped
rather than a sudden leap.
I think that sudden leap is a dangerous one for a lot of people.
Do you think, looking back, you're like, okay, I managed to navigate that level?
Not flawlessly, I have to say, Matt, not flawlessly.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, all the usual trials and tribulations and temptations of the rock and roll life were dabbled with, you know.
But you survived.
Yeah.
Get a good job with more pay in your own. get back.
Money by Pink Floyd from The Dark Side of the Moon, their eighth studio album from 1973, and still one of the biggest selling albums of all time. Featuring on vocals and guitar, my guest here on The First Time this week, David Gilmour.
Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. There was no promise made, the part you played, the chance you took. There are no boundaries set, the time and yet you waste it still. Like grains of sand, you watch it go. There's no time to be lost, you'll pay the cost, so get it right. There's no way out of here when you come in, you're in for good. Yeah.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is David Gilmour, and that was There's No Way Out of Here from David's first self-titled solo album.
The part you played, the chance you took.
78, your first solo record.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like four solo records in 37 odd years. It's not a lot.
It's a massive output, isn't it? I don't know how I've managed to keep that up.
Do you work better within a band environment, do you think, or used to?
Now I'm finding it great to be working sort of on my own and with some chosen people. But the initial band environment is one that I did really like and thought I was well suited to, more than being a solo. It was never really an ambition to be a solo artist, but it sort of comes upon you. And the band environment that you get into when you're very young and you have an absolute lack of respect for anyone that you're with and you know, treat them all as badly as you can treat your family, is something that as you get older and more successful and set in your ways, it's very hard to recreate. And people around often tend to defer to me too much. And I'm not always right, strangely.
That first solo record is lovely. I was going back in and listening to it. It's got some lovely stuff on it. Yeah. It's a beautiful record. Because from that sessions, with the first kind of genesis of Comfortably Numb comes from that era, doesn't it?
Well, yes. We recorded it in a studio in the south of France called Super Bear. And I did write and play the very first sort of demo guitar strumming of what became Comfortably Numb there. But it was too near the end of the sessions to progress it, I'm rather pleased to say.
History could have been so different.
Yeah.
Hello, hello, is there anybody in there? Just not if you can hear me. Is there anyone home? Come on, come on now. Get you on your feet again. Relax, relax. I need some information first. Just the basic facts. Can you show me where it hurts? There is no pain you are receiving. The distant ships move. Can you stand up? I do believe it's working.
It's not the first Fender Stratocaster, but it's got the first serial number, the one that you earned, 0001. Yeah. It's become this almost mythic instrument. Does it appear on many records?
It's been on one or two, but I can't remember which ones it's on.
It's one of the most famous guitars.
It is on that first solo album back in 78. It's definitely on the first track on that.
It's literally the sort of holy grail for many.
It's a very, very nice guitar. It's a lovely guitar, but it feels light and it feels a bit fragile, and I don't want to leave it lying around.
How do you get it?
Well, you know, when you're touring around, the people come up and there are all sorts of guitar specialists, particularly in the States, who hawk guitars that they've found, and my
with a sort of open jacket, here you are, mate, all right,
that sort of
got
thing.
0001 here, fancy it?
Yeah. And that one came through my road manager chap, Phil Taylor, and he bought it initially, and then I suggested that he sell it to me.
I've got a good idea for you here.
Gracefully. There's a lot of fuss about how people get their guitar sounds, but 90% of people's guitar sound is in their fingers. It's in the way they play it, and sometimes an anomaly of timing between your left and right hand or something just gives you a certain sound, or the way you use your fingers to pluck the strings. Anyone could go, I could go into any music store around the country and pick up a perfectly good guitar, amplifier and a couple of pedals and sound exactly like me. It's not, I mean, I think far too much fuss is made over the gear. I mean, you obviously want a nice, powerful, good amplifier and a nice guitar. But after that, I think it's mostly in the fingers.
To ask you about the first time you met Kate Bush.
A guy I know called Ricky Hopper was a friend of Kate's brother, and he came to me one day and said, I've got this tape of this 15-year-old girl singing, I think she's talented, and he played it to me, and I agreed that I did think she was very talented, but you know, her unusual vocal style and sound, I thought it was unlikely that record companies, A&R people, would get it. I was not convinced that they would get it instantly. So after some various tryouts, I decided to employ a full studio, Air Studios in London, with Jeff Emmerich engineering and with a friend of mine, Andrew Powell, producing and arranging. And I chose two or three songs out of about 50 that she had.
50, wow.
And I didn't spend a long time choosing. I just sort of thought, we'll have one nice slow one, one sort of medium tempo, one like this, and I just out of these things, thinking, that one, and we'll do those to releasable level, so that they weren't demos, so that they were actually properly ready to go tracks. And I thought that was the best way to take her to the record companies, to convince them. And the song The Man with the Child in His Eyes was one of those three.
I hear him before I go to sleep and focus on the day that's been. I realize he's there when I turn the light off and turn. Suddenly I find myself listening to He's very understanding. He's so aware of all my situations. When I stay up late, he's always waiting, but I feel him hesitate. Oh, I'm so worried about my love. They say, no, no, it won't last forever. And here I am again, my girl, wondering what on earth I'm doing here. Maybe he doesn't love me. I just took a trip on my love for him. This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I'm just playing around, baby. Welcome days, men who know wheels must turn to keep the flow.
Do you play guitar on Slave to the Rhythm by Grace Jones? Is this true?
Well, there are a number of versions of Slave to the Rhythm, and I did play on one. Trevor asked me to come down to a studio somewhere, I've no idea where it was, and asked me to play something on this track called Slave to the Rhythm, which I duly did. He was in agony. He had really bad stomach cramps, and he was lying on the floor moaning for the entire duration of the session. And that's all I can really remember about it. I'm not sure that I've ever actually heard it or could actually pinpoint which bit was me, because the way some of those records got made was unusual. I think it was the early Fairlight recording systems and the manipulation of the sounds that you could do afterwards, which we all do all the time now, makes it sometimes hard to spot which bit's you.
But you didn't have a chance to hang out with the incomparable Miss Grace Jones?
I have hung out with Grace a few times. Well, not hung out with her, but I have met her a few times. She's a wild woman.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
When did you first fall in love with Leonard Cohen? Because people either love Leonard or just don't get it, but the people that love him tend to love him.
I've always loved Leonard Cohen, and I can... you know those snapshot memories where you can think, there was a moment I can remember distinctly driving down the M1 in the van or in a car or something, off from a gig in probably 1968 or 69, listening to a track of Leonard Cohen on the radio and thinking how dour and dry and depressed it sounded in a kind of a wonderful way. It's very nice to hear how he's cheered up.
What song of his should we play at this juncture?
Famous Blue Raincoat, maybe. I like that one. I like a load of them.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? All the lines last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train. You came home without Lily Marlene, and you treated my woman to a flake.
When was your first musical collaboration with Polly?
First musical collaboration with Polly was on the Division Bell album, and I was, I guess, trying to inveigle her into helping me to write lyrics.
Did she need much inveigling?
no, she wanted me to do it, but she was willing to help, and she did more, much more, actually, than is sort of indicated on the record sleeve. Sort of a dishonesty or something, I suppose, at the time, where it looked like I had done more of it than I had, in fact, done. But there we are. She really, really pretty much wrote most of several of the songs on that album. Great moment, so terrific. High hopes. It was a high point of the writing on that album.
Has it always been very easy to work in the musical sphere with her?
Yeah, it's much more than just lyrics. You know, she has comments, brutally honest comments on almost every aspect of every song that we're doing. And she's always worth listening to.
The moment you think so.
High Hopes was a good moment at the time.
Beyond the horizon of the place we lived when we were young, in a world of magnets and miracles, straight constantly and without boundary. The ringing of the division bell had begun. Along the long road and on down the causeway, do they still be there by the cut? There was a ragged band that followed in our footsteps, running before time took our dreams away, leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener, the light was bright. Bridges glowing behind us, to a glimpse of how green it was on the other side. Steps taken forwards, but sleepwalking back again, dragged by the force of some inner tide.
So when did you first decide that Wrath of That Lot was going to have... it was kind of going to be themed around a journey across a life or a physical journey, because it's kind of both, isn't it? Did that come before the majority of the songs, or did it emerge, or was it always a plan?
No, it emerged as we went through, I suppose you'd say, in the later stages of the album. But it's been there for a considerable period of time, and you're trying to... it's always useful to try and tie things together in some way, so you've got a feeling of a kind of a chronology or a narrative that runs through it. I find that really helpful to giving it focus.
Mm. It does take you through all these different moments in these different moods. Obviously, the song about Rick is enormously effective.
Yes.
Beautiful. Was that a hard decision to take, to write in such an open way? Not that long, really, I guess.
Well, it didn't start off being about Rick, but I mean, I had written and recorded almost the entire musical track for it before Polly came up with those fantastic lyrics, and then it suggested to her there's a kind of a rolling thing about the piano, suggested waves, and Rick's life was sailing, you know, outside of music. Rick's life was sailing. He had a yacht, and he just loved living on his yacht, and that's, I think, what inspired Polly to write those words.
Did you have that moment when you first went into the studio and maybe looked to your left or right and expected to see him being there and realised he wasn't?
It's not really precisely like that, but sitting and thinking, what could we do with keyboards on this point? Where's Rick? We, you know, and thinking, no, damn, you know, who should I get that I could trust to do the same sort of job? And it's tricky.
Is it important for you to document your life in songs like that?
It's inevitable. I don't know about how important it is. It's an inevitability. You're going to find that there are things in your life that you're thinking about and that suggest themselves as song ideas that you feel like you want to write about.
So we've had all these firsts, and the final thing we do is we ask you to pick the last song, which can be anything you wish.
No, well, let's do In Any Tongue.
Why that song?
It's a really great track, which will make you think.
Make you think about what?
Ooh, you'll see. I don't want to dictate what it makes you think about.
Good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Home and done, it's just begun. Hard ways more than it ever did before. What has he done? God help my son. Hey, stay a while, I'll stay up. No sugar. The volume pump dried up.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by 6 Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.